You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
With a new year, often come resolutions to form positive habits and break bad ones. So it's fitting that our February Leonard Lopate Show book club selection, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, explores how habits work. Its author, Charles Duhigg, is a New York Times reporter. He joins us now to talk about his book, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
And we hope that you, our listeners, have been reading the book along with us. You can join our conversation now if you have a question about the book and habits by giving us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. So, Charles, how are habits different from other behaviors? What makes them different from conscious decisions?
Well, a habit starts as a decision that you made at some point, and then you stop making but continue acting on. So one of my favorite examples, which no one in New York does now, but everyone probably remembers, is backing your car out of a driveway, right? Remember, think back to when you were 16 and the first time you backed your car out of your driveway. This is actually an incredibly complicated activity because you have to measure reflected distances and keep things in mind and look for kids on bicycles and sort of reverse all your natural instincts. And yet after a month? It becomes totally automatic. You do it without thinking. In fact, you can turn on the radio station or fiddle with the channels while you're doing it.
It also applies to when you're walking. How many times have you found yourself at a destination and thought, well, I don't remember how I got here. I've just been walking.
Exactly.
My mind has been somewhere else. So what part of our brain controls our habitual behaviors?
Well, it's linked to a number of areas, and in particular a part known as the basal ganglia, which is one of the oldest structures within our brain.
And how do we know that?
We know it because in the last decade, there's been a number of experiments that have been able to study for the first time the neurology of habit formation. We're kind of living through this golden age of understanding habits. And what we've learned is that one of the reasons why habits exist is because without them, it would be very unlikely that any species would do well. Right, the ability to take a pattern and make it automatic so that it frees up mental space to, for instance, invent fire or aircraft carriers, that's a very important capacity. And without it, animals, particularly humans, would have to spend all of their mental energy figuring out just where to walk and what to eat.
So do most animals, at least mammals, have habits?
Absolutely. Almost every single animal has the capacity to develop habits. It's a fundamental prerequisite to really being able to be successful.
How are cravings important to how we develop habits?
Well, it's interesting because a craving is what makes a habit work. So to explain, let me tell you a little bit about the structure of what we now know of what a habit is. A habit actually has three parts. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for the behavior to start. And then an automatic behavior, which is the routine. And then finally, a reward. And the question is, why does your brain start to push you down that path? Why does that become an automatic relationship between these three things? And the answer is because of a craving for the reward. Once you pair a cue and an activity with an expected reward, your brain will start to crave it. Even if you weren't hungry 5 minutes ago, if you pass by the donut table, you're going to crave a donut.
But let's say you have to take a pill every 4 hours. We want to make that into a habit, but then there are times when 3 hours later we realize I haven't taken the last pill. Did I need the cue?
It's because of the cue and the reward. Right.
And well, so the reward is that I'm not going to have the problem that the pill is supposed to cure.
Well, it turns out that that's actually not a great reward. Most rewards, to be really effective, A, have to have a positive attribute, and B, have to deliver very, very quickly on that reward. So one of the things that they've done with medication, for instance, is they give it a coating that's really sweet, right? Because they want something that makes your brain, as soon as you put it on your tongue, to say, ah, I remember this. I like taking this pill. I get into the habit. The alarm goes off and I take the pill and it's a little burst of sugar. It's because when a reward is delivered, it usually has to be right away for it to have neurological import.
Haven't advertisers learned that they can cue habits?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not only is that why they show, you know, that those yummy hamburgers on the McDonald's commercials, it's also why when you look at a beer commercial, you see people drinking among their friends. Because particular people are often a type of cue for a certain type of behavior. They're trying to recognize the cues that are in your environment and then deliver them to you in the app.
But what happens when I'm not somebody who regularly throws around a beach ball with beautiful bikinied women on
you don't do that every
weekend? South Florida.
You know, for those of us who aren't lucky enough to have this experience.
Can I still drink the beer?
You can still drink the beer. You can still. In fact, if you'll notice beer commercials lately, they nowadays show very little of that. What they will show is they'll show usually three or four men together in a setting that looks generically like a bar. And the reason why there's fewer scantily clad women is because they recognize that that's not a cue that occurs in people's lives, but people become accustomed to drinking with their friends.
So they tried that out. It didn't sell a lot of beer, and then they did more scientific research.
That's exactly right.
On the other side of that beer commercial, Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the largest, best-known, successful habit-changing organizations in the world. How does it change habits to help people stop drinking?
Well, AA is a great example of understanding habit science, because AA was created by people who had no background in science whatsoever, right? They almost had no. The reason why there's 12 steps in AA is because Bill W. had to write them one night in a rush, and the Bible was sitting next to his bed, and he chose 12 because there's 12 apostles. And yet AA works for millions of people.
But it could have been just three.
It could have been three. It could have been seven. The secret with AA is that they give you the same cue and the same reward, and they change the routine. They change the behavior. So it used to be for a lot of people that when you had a tough day at work, you come home, you have a drink. The drink gives you this reward of kind of relaxation, social catharsis. You usually have it with friends, or it's easier to talk about your problems with your wife. What AA says is if you've had a tough day at work, that's the cue. Instead of going to a bar, come to a meeting. And at a meeting, we're going to give you the same thing. An AA meeting is this incredibly socially cathartic experience. It's the same reward.
Well, it's interesting that a listener wrote in that she always has a craving for a glass of wine every evening, and she doesn't have those cravings any other time. But having a drink has become a habit, and she wants to stop it. But does she have to go to an AA meeting? She's not an alcoholic.
Not at all. Not at all. And in fact, most alcoholics actually recover outside of a standardized treatment setting. But what she does need to do is she needs to figure out what reward is that glass of wine providing, and can I find another behavior that delivers a similar reward?
I'm sure she started because she thought it relaxed her.
And it probably does, right? Relief from tension is the most powerful reward.
But so we just need another reward.
No, you need another behavior that delivers a similar reward. So you can't willpower your way through and say, I'm not going to relieve my tension when I come home from work. What you need to say is, can I get the same relief from tension by taking a bath, by having a good conversation with my husband, by watching TV and enjoying, you know, a nice cup of tea or something to eat in front of the television?
Well, how can we figure out what the cue is that gets us to do something?
The key is to try and just do experiments, right? I used to have this bad cookie habit where I'd go eat a cookie every afternoon. And I wrote down what was happening every single time I went and I ate the cookie. And I figured out pretty quickly the only consistent thing is it always happened between 3:15 and 3:45. And then I figured out it was a time of day. And then I had to figure out what the reward was. And I figured the reward is a cookie because cookies taste good. And when I told the doctor, psychologist and neurologist, they'd be like, no. Rewards are much more complicated. It turned out in my case, and I learned this by doing experiments, the reward was that whenever I went up to the cafeteria, that's when I saw my friends and I socialized for 15 or 20 minutes. It wasn't really the cookie itself. The cookie was an excuse.
When I smoked, there were certain things that I did automatically. I would pull a cigarette out as I went up or down a staircase, whether it was getting out of the subway or leaving my home or some other place. Whenever I had to stop to think, I would reach for a cigarette. And it was really difficult to get past all of those things where my hand automatically went to the pack of cigarettes when I finally took a whole year to quit smoking. It was a very painful year.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that your brain starts craving the rush of nicotine whenever you walk up those stairs, right? In fact, to this day, you probably still, when you walk up those stairs, there's part of you that's craving that rush. And one of the easiest ways or best ways, because it's never easy, but one of the best ways to change that habit is to find some other behavior that gives you a similar reward.
Well, smoking is an addiction. Is there a clear line between what's a habit and what's an addiction?
There actually isn't. And it's interesting you bring up smoking because it's a great example. So smoking is an addiction, a physical addiction. But it turns out, according to medical studies, it's actually not that addictive. 100 hours after your last cigarette, when all the nicotine is out of your blood system, you are no longer physically addicted to nicotine. And yet we all know people that 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years after having their last cigarette, they still crave them, right? That's not because of a physical addiction. That's because of a habit. But to someone in the grip of a habit, an addiction and a habit feel exactly the same.
There are some common bad habits like nail biting that you write about. What did you discover about those habits?
So what's interesting about nail biting is actually one of the most studied habits because the only people who bite their nails tend to be fairly intelligent people, and so they can elucidate what's going on. Most people bite their nails when they're either bored or anxious. And the reason why is because you get a little pain sensation when you bite your nails. And that pain sensation is enough of a reward because it blanks out, it overwhelms for a second your boredom or your anxiety. For a microsecond, right? It doesn't solve your problems, doesn't make them go away. But for a microsecond, you don't think about being bored or anxious. That's enough of a reward to create a habit. And the way that you change it is you figure out the cues, right? You pay attention to when you're biting your nails just by making little hash marks on a card. And then you find a new routine that delivers a similar reward, whether that means scratching your arm or wrapping your knuckles or just clenching your fists or taking a deep breath. You can find something to replace it.
Well, in the case of my quitting smoking, what I did is every time I wanted a smoke, I kept a pack of cigarettes as a prevention against going crazy. I would go and then I would go through this whole process of explaining to myself why I didn't want the cigarette. And after a while, I realized the cigarettes were stale and they would taste terrible. So I got past that part.
I mean, what's wonderful about that example is that it shows, you know, reward is this incredibly important part of the habits, right? This habit loop. And yet it shows that one of the unique things about humans is that we can decide how much reward value a reward has. Simply changing how we think about a reward, we know from MRI studies, actually changes how rewarding that is.
My guest is Charles Duhigg. D-U-H-I-G-G, his book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. It's this month's Leonard LoPage Show book club selection. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692, and we'll get to the calls in just a moment. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org, or you can write to us on Facebook or Twitter. Before we get to the calls, I want to talk about Michael Phelps. You write that his success is in part due to his habits, keystone habits. Can you explain what keystone habits are and how they work?
Yeah, one of the things that we've learned is that some habits matter more than others. For some reason, if you change some habits, it sets off a chain reaction that seems to change other patterns in people's lives or within communities or companies. So Michael Phelps is a great example in that he chose this one habit to build his day around. And as a result, everything else just kind of fell into place. A great example of how this works for other people is exercise, right? There's a lot of people, studies show, that when they start exercising habitually, they start eating better. Their eating habits change. And that makes sense because you feel better about your body. But on average, also, people who start exercising habitually start using their credit cards less frequently. They do their dishes earlier in the day. They procrastinate about 20 minutes less at work. Now, that doesn't make any sense because there's nothing about running that would make you not pull your plastic out of your wallet. And yet, for a lot of people, exercise is a keystone habit. When you start exercising, your mental concept of yourself starts to change. And subconsciously, you're at the cash register and you say, you know, I'm the type of guy who goes running every day. I don't need to buy this thing that I don't need. I'll just leave my credit card in my pocket.
So Michael Phelps doesn't charge things?
Michael Phelps, he probably charges a number of things. But what he does is he routinizes everything about his life, so that by the time he's in a race, it feels just like a practice. He's already won in his mind, and winning is actually kind of anticlimactic for him.
Well, obviously, he has learned to organize things, and that's what you're describing. I'm not sure I want to be that organized. A little spontaneity is okay, too, and it's the reason that I sometimes have to talk myself into going to the gym.
Exactly. I mean, what's interesting about Phelps, though, is that he is spontaneous in other ways, right? I mean, one of the most marvelous things about creating patterns and habits for ourselves is that it frees up mental activity so that spontaneity, unexpected spontaneity, can occur, right? If you talk to Chuck Close, the artist, he'll say that he comes up with rules about how he paints because once he has rules, he can be more creative. That's exactly what patterns and habits do for our lives. They create rules that allow genuine spontaneity because we don't have to concentrate on what we're doing.
Let's take some calls. First caller is Alan from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks very much for taking my call. Until we actually have a Congress willing to pass a carbon tax, which would create a cue for reducing our emissions, can you recommend any ways that people can develop habits or cues and reward systems to reduce their carbon emissions?
You mean like not flying in airplanes?
Right. That's an interesting question. I mean, what's interesting to me is how, you know, just 10 or 15 years ago, recycling was kind of this like fringe activity, right? I mean, it was this type of thing that like you did if you were really committed to the environment. Now it's really easy. Now everyone almost everyone recycles in New York. Part of that is because we have to by law, but part of it is that it's become a habit. And I think it's because there's this positive reinforcement around it. Pride, a sense of pride, is one of the most powerful types of rewards. If you want to create a behavior, like, for instance, using less carbon, then you need to recognize and celebrate when people do it, which I think is one of the reasons why the Prius is so popular. It looks so different. It broadcasts to everyone, I care about Earth. If it looked just like a normal car, maybe let fewer people would drive it.
You say that one of the ways to lose weight is to keep a food log.
Yes.
Is that connected to habits?
It is, because one of the things that happens is that when you're trying to change a habit, you're trying to interrupt the automaticity, right? You're trying to draw people's attention to those cues and rewards. When you force people to write down what they're eating, and food logs, by the way, are the number one way to lose weight. I mean, this has been shown in study after study. When you force people to write down what they're eating, you force them to consider why they're eating it, what reward it's actually delivering.
Well, most people who are judgmental say that overweight people just don't have enough willpower. Does willpower play a role in the breaking of habits, especially keystone habits?
Well, our concept of willpower has changed a lot in the last couple of years. Willpower is now recognized as a muscle, right? You can build it and you can get it stronger, but no matter how strong you are, if you lift weights all day long, by the end of the day, your arm's going to be tired. And that's exactly what happens with breaking a habit. If you try and break a habit, if you try and willpower through it, you can do it. You can do it for maybe an entire day, maybe an entire week, but you'll reach this point of exhaustion. That's why changing the habit is much more powerful.
And it's not just on a personal level. You write about corporate attempts to break habits, both positively and negatively.
Absolutely.
Starbucks, you say, is a good corporate example. It teaches willpower?
It teaches willpower habits to its employees, very specifically. They have all these little habit loops that they teach. One of my favorites is this thing called the latte habit, which is that if an irate customer comes in, that's a cue, you're supposed to latte them immediately, which means you automatically listen to their problem, acknowledge they've got a problem, thank them for bringing the problem, take care of the problem, and give them a free cup of coffee, and then explain it'll never happen again. And the reward is that this previously irate customer is now happy. I've seen this happen. It's like magic. People automatically do customer service because they're not even really thinking about it. They're just reacting.
Companies also want to manipulate the habits of customers, not just their employees. How does Target look at customer buying habits?
Well, Target's a great example of this. Target is so good at analyzing data to figure out customer habits that they're able to tell when a customer is pregnant based on how her buying patterns change. And they'll start sending you new ads, hinting at the fact that they know that you're pregnant. In fact, in one case that we mentioned this in the New York Times Magazine, a father once came into a Target and was upset because his daughter had been getting all these ads. She's like 19 years old. And he says, are you trying to encourage her to get pregnant? And the manager called a couple days later to apologize again. And he said, well, turns out that she's due in August. She hadn't told me yet. There is this incredible power in using data to analyze and forecast people's habits. You can pretty much tell what's going on inside their life.
Well, let's go to David from Brooklyn. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, David. Quick.
Yes. My name is David, and I have a quick question about changing the habit. So I'm a nail biter, and over time, yes, changing the habit to just putting my fingers in my mouth has improved my ability to not bite my nails. But you also mentioned, you know, tapping fingers and tapping heels. And, you know, one of the reasons that I want to quit biting my fingernails is I find it annoying, and other people do too. But the things that you're suggesting I replace it with, I would think would just be equal in annoying to someone else or myself.
So he's saying replacing a habit with a habit, is that necessarily the way you want to go?
Well, what's interesting is that studies show that if you replace nail biting with, say, tapping your foot or like wrapping your nails or scratching yourself, for some reason, over about 6 weeks on average, you'll stop doing that other activity. That there's something about making yourself conscious of the behavior that starts to diminish its power over you. In fact, nail biting, in the book we describe how this one therapist treats nail biting. And this guy's record is about 100% of stopping nail biting within 3 or 4 weeks, even people who have bitten their nails their whole life. And what's interesting is he gives them a replacement habit, and that replacement habit just kind of disappears on its own eventually.
Another industry that tracks and uses people's habits to target customers is the gambling industry.
Absolutely.
You write about Angie Bachman, a woman who had a gambling problem. And what happened to her?
She ended up losing $1 million playing.
Did she have $1 million?
She had inherited money from her parents, and she ended up losing all of it and losing her house. And what's interesting is we think of gambling as an addiction, right? And yet when people have gambling problems, there's no chemical entering their body. It's a habit dysfunction, and it's as powerful to those people as a physical addiction is to a cocaine addict. What's going on there is that casinos are designed to take advantage of that reward craving, right? In fact, slot machines used to be kind of unprofitable until they were essentially reinvented by this guy from the video game industry, who figured out that if you give people small little rewards, like a brand new sound, a bell showing, a coin ever so often when they don't expect it, not enough rewards that they make money, they'll gamble for up to 5 or 6 times as long. They take advantage of our need for rewards, and they plot them out precisely.
And Angie? Well, she lost $1 million.
She lost. So
that's a good way to lose a habit.
Well, what's interesting is she ended up suing the casino, saying that they had taken advantage of her habit, and she lost in court. And the last time I talked to her, she told me that if she had the money, she would go gamble again.
You write about the Montgomery bus boycott and the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. How did he create habits that created movements to change society?
There's an interesting question when it comes to the Montgomery bus boycott, which is why then? Why Rosa Parks? Why did everyone stop riding the bus after Rosa Parks for a whole year? Why not? There had been other people who'd been arrested for sitting in the white section on a bus. And the answer was because Martin Luther King knew how to take advantage of the habits of a community, the obligations of friendship. Rosa Parks was well known and well liked. And Martin Luther King posed it as, if anyone sees you riding a bus, you're not just turning your back on Rosa Parks, you're turning your back on this entire community. The peer pressure of that was enough to fuel a movement for an entire year. Previously, no one had thought to use peer pressure, and peer pressure is a form of a social habit.
How much do my habits influence those around me, my family and friends?
That's a good question. I don't. You tell me. It turns out. I mean, I think.
They get annoyed when I bite my nails.
They probably.
They're pleased I no longer smoke.
Exactly. Exactly. One of the things that we know is that one of the most powerful types of cues is the presence of certain other people and the behaviors that we see in them. Right. There's usually about five. There's really 5 kinds of cues, and one of them being this social experience. The habits that we're exposed to, we become normalized to. And so if your kids see you smoking, it seems normal. They learn your cues from you, and they find the rewards the same way. The behaviors that we see around us, we eventually become unless we fight hard against them.
So our kids, we model our habits for our kids, and our kids wind up doing similar things.
Absolutely. In part because praise is this hugely powerful reward, right? And if you do something that you see your father do or your mother do, there's an inherent element of praise. You're rewarding that. That's why I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and my wife is always saying that I have to, you know, be nicer to people, taxi drivers and Time Warner customer service representatives on the phone, because otherwise I'm teaching them this habit, this social habit, and the fact that I'm doing it assigns a praiseworthy reward element in my kids' minds.
By the way, on the other side, that person you're not screaming at, you're being very nice to in asking for something, that person appreciates it a lot more. The minute they hear you start screaming at them, they turn off and you're going to get a lousy customer service.
That's probably true. Although I have to say, when it comes to Time Warner, being nice has not seemed to make it any easier.
The power of habit. Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business has been this month's Leonard LoPage Show book club selection. My great thanks to Charles Duhigg, who is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Did you treat this like an investigative report?
I did. When it came to, a lot of the companies, Target, for instance, wouldn't talk to me anymore. They told all their staff to stop talking to me. The gambling company that we talk about, now known as Caesars Entertainment, would not respond.
That was Harrah's?
Previously Harrah's. Here's the thing about habits is that the reason why they're so powerful is because they touch at these core emotions for people, right? People can feel successful. They are successful. And then you ask them, what bugs you about your life? And they say, I can't stop biting my nails, or I wish I could exercise more. This gets to the core emotional, our emotional life. That's actually why I wrote this book, is because I wanted to understand for myself and for other people, what are the tools to take total control over who I am? And you have to treat that like an investigative project, because people get upset when you start asking them those questions.
The Power of Habit is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.